Hello, in this, the latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff, episode 23 in the series, I'm in conversation with Andrew Young, Chief Operating Officer at the London School of Economics. We talk about Andrew's career history, from Newcastle to the capital, and the joys and challenges of working in an institution with such a distinctive history and character as the LSE, as well as the experience of the London context for university staff working patterns. The excellent response of staff to the start of the lockdown is covered, along with the need to move quickly and beyond prepared incident management procedures and remain agile in order to be ready for the next time, be it another pandemic or even, as Andrew suggests, a meteorite strike. In such circumstances, there is a real reliance on all staff pulling together, drawing on everyone's institutional knowledge, but also, as Andrew notes, retaining a sense of perspective on the usual administrative challenges and giving colleagues a space to work through the difficult issues. We also discuss the distance between ministers and universities in terms of decision making and the need for Whitehall to be better informed about the realities of higher education operations rather than just issuing edicts. Finally, we look at the issues around the possibility of university closures and mergers post-pandemic, concluding that the latter seems quite likely in the years ahead. Much to enjoy, therefore.
Welcome, everyone, to the latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. And this time, it's my enormous pleasure to introduce Andrew Young. Andrew is at the LSE, and I've already forgotten his title, which is slightly embarrassing. But Andrew, welcome, and do please tell us what your actual title is and what you do in your role.
I'm Chief Operating Officer. I've been at the LSE for about 5 years now. What do I do? Well, I fix most things and try and keep the place pointing in one direction. And usually it works, or it has done so far. So I don't run all of the services, but I don't have the kind of the traditional academic services, library and the research services, but I have pretty much all of the rest. So that's what I do.
So how did you end up at the LSE then? What's your career trajectory?
Yeah, well, before that I was I'm the LSE's first Chief Operating Officer, and prior to that I was London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine's first Chief Operating Officer. So I reckon I specialise in going to places where they're not quite sure what they want, but the fancy new title seems like the right thing to do, so they picked me twice. So at least there's no one they've got to compare me with anyway, which is always a handy thing, I find. And before that, I was at Newcastle for years and years and years. I did a PhD at Newcastle and then worked my way into administration and really enjoyed it, actually. And I just took the decision sort of around about 10 years ago that I probably wanted to try one of these big jobs. And as I say, I got a chance at Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, which is wonderful. It's a fabulous organisation. They do some amazing things. And then 3 years later, the LSE job came up, and I thought, I wonder what that'd be like, a social scientist. Give it a try. So I did, and here I am. I'm still here. So
LSE is a kind of really distinctive university in UK higher education. And I mean, what's it like as a place to? I mean, we'll come on to kind of pandemic stuff in a minute, but in normal circumstances, what's it like as a place to work? Because it seems incredibly cosmopolitan, but also it's got this very, very rich and distinctive history.
Yeah, and I think you're aware of that at the LSE. You do feel that a little bit, actually, and possibly more than anywhere else that I've worked. And so that wasn't a surprise when I got there. It is incredibly cosmopolitan. It's based on the Old Wych in London, between the Old Wych and Lincoln's Inn Fields, and of course it's about 50% postgraduate, and it's about 60% international. That's been a particular challenge for us, I have to say. It's also a particular challenge because we had this particular issue, Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, where they only have 600 master's students, and that's their students for you. So we have about 10,500 students, but about 7,000 of those are new every year. And so you've got your new first year undergraduates, and then you've got all the master's students. So that's a bit of a challenge because, of course, people turn over every year. Lots of new starters every year, forming new friendship groups every year. And so that puts a particular slant on, you know, we focus quite hard on accommodation, for instance, because it really matters. If you're going to be there for a year, you don't want to be messing about in private accommodation. So we're trying to expand our housing stock. We have this amazing public lecture series, you know, these major series of major public events. I shook hands with Nancy Pelosi last year, who probably was the most powerful woman in the Western world, you know, when you think about it. Absolutely amazing. Her views on Trump were hilarious. But it was public, so I can say that, I think. But it's lovely, you know, and so they get lots of people at that sort of level. And it's quite startling, really, that, you know, that just across the road from me on my campus, you've got this, you know, world leaders and so on. So that's been really interesting. So it's a very interesting place, actually. And I know a lot more about economics now than I ever did. And actually, quite a lot of economics is about human behavior, which is particularly interesting to me because I came from a science, a straight science background. So that's been really interesting because it's rather opened my eyes to social science, actually, and the value of social science. And I was a zoologist, ecologist, agric, to see some of the social science aspects of what I was doing as a pure scientist is quite interesting to see how that plays out in economics terms and so on. So that's been a very interesting experience.
And in terms then of the professional services for which you're responsible, is there anything that you're aware of that's kind of distinct or unusual about the setup at LSE, or is it you know fairly typical of contemporary university life?
I think it's fairly typical. I have to say when I arrived, I don't think the professional services staff got the credit they deserved. And I spent quite a lot of time on that, actually, because that works both ways. Because if you don't give people a chance to shine and give them the credit for it when they do, then they don't bother. And so I think, that's a very general view. And of course, it wasn't unilaterally like that. Of course, in the institution, people have all sorts of abilities. But I think we've built a much more self-confident team. And obviously in the last few months we've really seen the benefit of that, because we've pulled rabbits out of hats all over the place, and that's been really important, actually, because we've all had to be, haven't we, Paul, so much more agile and prepared to just give something a go and come up with the best ideas and try them out. So I think that's been an important thing. They're different in that sense, I think. It's different working in London. That is very different to working up in Newcastle. I mean, that's very, very different. The hours are very different. Tend to be much later start. You know, it's trivial things. We tend to start much later in the mornings and work into the evenings much more than I would have done in Newcastle, say, for instance. So things like that do kind of change the character a bit. And of course, staff turnover is quite high as well, because there's relatively speaking a lot of opportunities in London which you don't have in other places as well. So you sometimes have to work hard to keep your staff. So that's a real challenge as well.
And then on the you talk about the response to the pandemic there. I mean, you know, there was a sense in which, you know, we could see it coming a bit, but then we all had to respond incredibly quickly. Did you feel that you had kind of the plans in place that you needed in terms of instant response and your ability to move very quickly, or was it, you know, bit making it up as you go along?
I think if we look back, I think it was definitely making up as we go along. I mean, we thought we had the plans. Of course we did. We thought we'd done all that business continuity work and we'd paid attention in those workshops and so on and so forth. But of course, I wonder whether COVID's actually any different to any other real crisis. What you do is, when you practice these things, is you come up with a sort of the framework of what you do. But actually what you do is very much driven by the moment. And I think that was very much the case when we went into all of this in February and March. I mean, we ramped up our meetings. They all seemed to work. We got the right people in the room. We did the right things, actually. But I don't think we knew what we were going to do before we got in a room and had to make a decision PDQ. I think there's a lot of it, but I think, you know, it's all about people in the end, isn't it? And I think we had the right people in the room, and they were all sensible folk, and they had some good ideas, and we tried them and it worked. So I'm not sure you'd be any different if the meteorite struck, or you know.
Well, it depends where it lands, doesn't it?
Yeah, true. Yeah. But you know, it's I just, in terms of the actual, you know, we had no idea what we were going to do next, if you like. To that extent, we were making up as we were going along. We still are, because we know the guidance appears at different points in time. Yeah. We're all at different points in our own preparation. So you have to remain agile and you rely on really good people at that point, don't you?
So, I mean, one of the things that struck me about it was the way in which, yes, you've got the plans, but actually in practice, things turn out very differently. But it is about, you know, people drawing on their knowledge of, you know, the way in which, you know, the institution is organized, who they know, all the resources you can marshal to ensure that you execute those plans. But it did seem to me that people came together in a way that I've never seen before. Across the institution, and essentially everyone stepped up, right? It was a, you know, kind of real sense of shared understanding of the challenge faced, and you know, every part of the university had to do something that was different and that was above and beyond. And I found that massively encouraging, I have to say. And you know, kudos to all my colleagues who really pulled their finger out, you know, academic community, you know, health and safety, all parts of professional services as well. It was remarkable, and I think that's, you know, an extremely positive thing to take away at the end of all of this. Although no one could have anticipated you would be running, you know, full pelt for 9 months, yeah, and thinking, is it Christmas yet?
Yeah, surely it must be Christmas by now.
Yeah,
that's absolutely true. I as it happens, I've just been to a meeting with one of my departments, and they were all very nice. And they said, but what else could we do? And I said, my response was this. It was, so we didn't, you know, for reasons I won't go into, we struggled to get a timetable out this year on time. And I had expected, an eruption. And it didn't happen. And I think to build on your theme of people really pulling together, actually, they really, when things weren't going well, what we didn't get was our inboxes full of, you're an idiot, you really don't know what you're doing, do you realize how much damage this is causing the organization? Actually not getting a timetable out was rather put in perspective by the pandemic itself. So actually what I said was, thank you for just giving us the space to work out particular problems. And that wouldn't have happened before. That would have been a very difficult moment for the chief operating officer. And it didn't happen like that. So that was great. I think one of the real tricks at the end of this, whenever that's going to be, will be how we harness that and how we maintain those good relationships and use it to help develop our organisations in a way that we wouldn't have been able to do before. Yeah. And being able to deliver teaching online is just one of them. There are many others in terms of the running of the organisation that we need to retain.
Well, so on that particular issue then, I mean, we all had to adapt suddenly very quickly to, you know, to working at home and working remotely, and obviously, you know, academic colleagues to teaching and assessing remotely as well. In terms of your areas then, the way in which professional service colleagues, you know, managed to work remotely, do you think that, I mean, how has that actually worked? I mean, is there a new model for how professional services will work in future? Or was it, you know, kind of make do and mend for the time being, and then it'll be back to normal in 6 months?
Well, it was make do and mend to start with. Of course, we all just picked up what we could carry and went home. And there's still a bit of that. We spent quite a lot of money on improving people's home arrangements, but actually, we just did a pulse survey of all of our staff, and it's quite incredible the proportion of our staff who are really happy working in the way they're working at the moment. I often jokingly say, no one ever said, I miss the commute. And of course, that's a particularly London issue. Nobody does. What everybody does now is, instead of commuting, they just work. So the days, you know, the day's just expanded by an hour or more each end of the day, the working day, I mean. So, no, absolutely, we have grand plans for ditching all of our rented properties. And doubling up the where the services will occupy our owned properties. And so it will take a significant reduction in floor area, but actually we're pretty much certain that it's Well, I mean, we were thinking about agile working in the past. You know, we'd not really adopted agile working, so we were thinking about it. Of course, we were sitting there twiddling our thumbs, thinking, "How on earth are we going to do this?" Now I'm wondering how we're going to get everybody back. And so it's actually it's the reverse problem almost. I don't think we'll have any problem having 50% of our PS staff in the services working away from our buildings in one way or another. So that's going to be very different, and it's going to be, you know, I've got a new EA and I've not actually met her yet, and she's been working for me for 6.5 months. So, I mean, I've seen her, but I haven't actually met her. And you know, it's absolutely incredible. You would think, well, that would be really difficult, wouldn't it? Chief Operating Officer's EA, got to come in and learn all of this stuff, work out who he talks to and who he doesn't want to talk to, and all of those sorts of things. And of course you've got to meet, because you've got to sit down and discuss that, but of course you don't. You now all realise that actually there are ways of doing things like induction, familiarisation, and so on, and you can do it remotely. So I think we're all learning, aren't we? I wouldn't have believed it was possible.
So you are planning for a model which, you know, essentially sees, you know, it's part time on campus, part time off campus. I must admit, you know, we're working on exactly the same basis, and there's some people who have to be here all the time because that's what their job entails. Others, you know, it can be much more mixed, as you described. But I mean, the thing that I've noticed most in terms of, working off-site for a long period of time is trying to recreate the opportunity for the accidental conversation is incredibly difficult. Mm-hmm. And, I'm in my office today and, there aren't many other people in the building, but those few conversations you can have face-to-face actually feel much more valuable than they would have felt 9 months ago. there's a real value attached to those unplanned short conversations, and you know, the combination of those two things seems to me the ideal scenario.
I agree. So I've been there only a few times, and it does matter that you just have a bit of face-to-face contact with some people. The majority of the people who sort of expressed an opinion, it was a sort of fairly typical bell curve. You had a few people who never wanted to come back ever again, and a few people who never wanted to leave. And then most people are somewhere in the middle, and there is a peak around about 50-50. That was the data that we got. So it was quite interesting to see how that panned out. People do want to retain that ability to come and have a bit of a chat with people in that very informal way, because I don't think we've nailed how to do it online. You can't do it. It just doesn't happen by accident. If there's one thing that we have to retain is that a speedy core that comes with the meeting people in corridors and just while talking to the security staff in the street or actually buying a sandwich at your own catering outlet and saying hi to the person behind the counter, and knowing that actually you do exist, you are human, and you're part of something that's worth being part of. And I do worry that we endanger that, because there's a great extent to which the professional services staff are the heart of the organisation. I know that's hearsay when you say it to an academic. You have to be very careful with who listens to this afterwards. But, you know, they have their own world, and the LSE, it's around arguing with each other about all sorts of things. But they're coming and going from campus all the time anyway, and the people who are there most of the time are that PS group. So if you take half of them away for a proportion of the time, I think there's a bit of a risk there that you lose that continuity that Jimmy or Jenny are always behind that desk when your academics walk in the morning, and there's always that familiar face there. Well, that won't happen in future.
I think that's a really, really good point, Andrew, because it's about creating an environment in which things can work, but also that both students and academic staff feel that there is, you know, there is actually, you know, people managing the infrastructure to enable their lives to continue, and that it's done by humans and not robots. And I do think that is really, really important. Yeah. And there is also a sense in which, you know, you can ask anyone anything, right? But it's probably only a professional services colleague who has a chance of, knowing what the answer is. You know, if you're wandering around campus or whatever. Yeah. So without that, then you know, it's just another kind of open environment with loads of people milling about and not knowing exactly what's going on. So I think there's something in that. Whether 50-50 will be a critical mass, I guess we'll find out. Yeah. And students will tell us. They'll say, actually, this place feels like it's deserted half the time, or, you know, I can never find anyone who tells me what I need to know. That kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, to give you an example, actually, at our place, one of the things that was a surprise to us is we had this big debate in September about who we needed to have back on campus. And we have a marvelous student service centre. Great people who sit on the front desk and talk to students. You know, they come in, students come in, and there's a problem, and they talk to them. And the usual pattern of behaviour is that the students come in there to start with at the start of term. They find out the sort of logistical things that they need to know, the bits and pieces that get them into the education, and then their contact point gravitates to their department. So we see a drop off. A few weeks into term. We didn't see that this time. They'd never transferred onto their department, which is quite interesting, because actually there haven't been as many people in departments, because departments tend to have fewer PS staff in. So if half of them are not there, there's really not very many people in those departments, but there's always somebody on the front desk in the student service centre. And so they've latched onto that, and they've stayed latched onto that, and haven't unlatched them and got themselves out of the department.
Yeah.
So we're keeping our staff in for longer, basically. And you know, that's a really interesting thing that we'd never have thought of.
Yeah. No, you couldn't have anticipated that. One of the interesting things for me is the way that various external agencies, Department for Education, OFS, etc., have behaved in relation to universities. And we're all intrigued to see what the Department for Education is going to come up with next in terms of its advice and guidance for the sector. I mean, we've only just had our instructions on how to end the term, and so students can go home for Christmas. We're eagerly awaiting further advice on the return. And I mean, it feels to me, without going into any of the specifics, because they're, you know, many of them are unknown at the time that we're talking, but, you know, there is a sense in which you kind of wonder how close they are to what's going on in universities, how much of an idea they really have about how universities are organised, because there isn't a massive amount of evidence to suggest that they're talking to, you know, to people in universities about how they work.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think this is a really difficult one, and without wanting to end up in the tower, I think you're probably right. One of the things I think is a bit of a problem is that there's usually a more or less fully formed idea of what they want that then enters a consultation period, rather than a consultation which helps to come to something that might work. And I'm not necessarily having to go at the DfE, because I think, you know, they've obviously got a million things to do as well. And I mean, I think one of the things that would have really helped us with this end of term stuff would be, had it appeared 2 weeks earlier, we'd have all had a bit more time to actually think this through. And so I think that's one of the problems, actually, is that they start with a solution and then come and attempt to make it fit, rather than try and just work with, you know, a group of people from the sector and work, you know, let's see what we could actually make work for the majority of the people for the majority of the time. And actually, that's probably the best you're ever going to get, really. Because we're a pretty diverse sector, you know. You and I are in quite different organisations, and we're both, you know, in that particular group of institutions. So I think we've got to. I think I cut them a bit of slack, but I think the last minuteness, and yes, don't come to us with a, you know, here's the problem. It's end of term. We need to do X, Y, and Z and achieve these things from our side. What are we going to do, folks? And I think we'd have got along a lot better. I think we'd have just found a friction-free way of coming up with an answer, which would have helped everybody.
Indeed, and it's the kind of thing that we're actually quite good at. Because we're doing it all the time. No, I agree. And I mean, part of it is just, I think, a traditional approach to wanting to direct and to say, as you say, this is the answer. Now let's find out how to get there, which is, you know, that's the easy way to approach things, particularly, you know, if you are in government. And we see the minister and secretary of state do it, you know, regularly when they, you know, they make a decision. It might be about admissions. It might be about, you know, concerns about degree classification. Whatever it is, they think that they can issue an edict and that we will all, you know, line up that behind it. And actually, we're all autonomous institutions.
Yeah.
And we're all very different in all sorts of ways.
Yeah. And it's not just about what we think about their idea. It's sometimes it's just not going to be possible to do that. And you know, if we mess around with the start of term in January, we've got thousands of overseas students who are flying back on the 2nd of January, and they're doing that, and they've booked their flights, and they've paid a lot of money for those flights to be back in the country on date X.
Yeah.
Now, don't mess about with the start of term. You know, don't mess about with the start of term. That's not a great idea. So I just think, you know, I need a bit of help, really.
But
as I say, I don't want to just slag off the government. They've got a lot of things to think about too, other than universities and keeping people in jobs and keeping the economy going is absolutely of overriding importance. But you know, I think we could probably just be a bit more collaborative.
No, I agree, and I think helping them understand that the longer term consequences of short term decisions that they might take now about January, you know, are potentially massive for our sector, and will carry huge both reputational but also financial implications for us if, you know, spanners are inadvertently chucked into the works, and that causes me grave concerns. But hopefully we'll be able to get our message across. One final thing then, Andrew, is kind of looking again longer term. I mean, what's your thinking about how, when we get to the other side of this and everyone's vaccinated and it's all hunky-dory, right? What's your, we are still going to be entering, you know, or in a period of significant financial challenge, right? So how do you think that's going to play out in our sector, right? Because we already know there were universities, you know, potentially struggling. Some international recruitment may have paid off, but you know, we're still a long way to go to where. How do you think it will shake out? I mean, will there be mergers? Will there be closures? What's going to happen?
I think there might be mergers. I'd actually be surprised if there was closures. Why do I think that? Because I think we're going to have an element of the economy struggling, and as I recall the figures. Universities tend to do well when the economy isn't, because people take training and education at a point when they have a gap in their working life. So I think the demand will stay pretty high. I think some individual institutions are clearly going to find it very hard. I mean, I think, you know, we have found it very difficult simply because of the number of overseas students that we've got and whether or not and because we're built on a model that brings in very high fees. You know, so whilst on the face of it, if you looked at our accounts, you think, look at that EBITDA, they're rolling in it. They're rolling in it, but bear in mind, 60 to 70% of our students are here for a year. So it is absolutely about cash flow for us. I think we've been, we've been pretty prudent. I think, well, we will be fine. I'm pretty certain we'll be fine. But I could see why other institutions who perhaps don't have the call on such substantial fees might find it very difficult. I think that politically, I think the government will find it very difficult actually to let an institution go. There might be one or two who get quite close to the edge, and there's quite a lot of noise around it. And you know, you can imagine where they are. But I think the government won't let it go. I think they just won't do it because the political pain will be too great. Now, longer term, I think we might see some entrepreneurial vice chancellors thinking, actually, a merger with that other place not so far away might be a really good thing, and it might happen. But I just can't see the government letting institutions go.
Yeah, no, I think I'm with you. I've been incredibly bold step to take. And, you know, particularly as many of them might be in marginal constituencies, you know, I think it would be really difficult, and the messaging would be terrible. Mergers, I agree. I mean, I think are much more likely, but I mean, mergers that have been successful in the past have been based on, you know, some significant investment of additional resource to help oil the wheels. And I don't sense much prospect of that. So they may be born out of emergency and crisis rather than you know, a bonus.
Shotgun marriage, really. I mean, I think if you do invest at that point, then the future looks better, doesn't it? But it doesn't look better if you're a member of an organisation that's having to merge with the one next door in order to keep your head above water, because, you know, it ends up as fewer jobs, less input, less financial input to your local economy, and so on. It's never a happy place, is it?
Yeah. Although the one area in which people have always talked about mergers is London, because there are arguably still disproportionately large number of universities in London. But then London remains a very, very attractive destination for both UK and overseas students. So,
yeah, indeed. And I think, you know, it generally has to be forced. I think recent experience, and I won't, no names, no pack drill, recent experience suggests that, you know, there has to be a crisis somewhere for one of the big boys to get interested.
Right, on that note, we'll leave it there. Andrew, it's been an absolute joy talking to you. Thank you very much indeed for your time, and very best of luck with the post-Christmas manoeuvres at the LSE and the future as we come out of the pandemic. So thank you again for your time.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
That's all then from University Registrars talking about stuff this time. There'll be plenty more along in due course. And if you can't wait, then please do check out the Registrarism blog on wonky.com, where you'll find lots of higher education comment and fun and games. Until next time.